This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Today, Beirut digs through the rubble with grief and anger.
You have new prime ministers, you know, every few years, and yet the corruption is endemic.
Also, on the 75th anniversary of Hiroshima, 21st century nuclear powers are stoking new rivalries.
What is the goal of what we're doing here? Are we going to compete in an arms race? Kind of looks like we're going out of our way to start one rather than preclude one.
And in Thailand, they're considering a progressive same-sex marriage law, but one that stops short of full equality.
They are comparing transgender with some other bad behavior.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to have you with us today. 2 days after a massive blast ripped through Beirut, the city remains in a state of shock. Leaders around the world are calling for an outpouring of aid. Until that arrives, it's the people of Beirut who are on the front lines, providing direct relief to their fellow citizens most in need. Robbie Shibley directs one of those grassroots efforts. He's at Beirut's Center for Civic Engagement and Community Service. After the catastrophic explosion, Shibley put out a call seeking volunteers to help clear rubble, sweep glass, and hang doors. He received more than 1,000 offers of help. Robbie joins us not far from the epicenter of the blast. Thank you very much for making time for us. I know this has got to be overwhelming. You're in the area now that's going to need help really fast. What does it look like where you are?
I'm overlooking the epicenter of the crisis, the port area. I can see St. George Hospital, which has been totally destroyed. This is where 13 patients got killed because of the explosion, in addition to 6 of the medical staff members, and it's out of operation now. And around me, I have tens of volunteers sweeping the floors, trying to clear the debris, the smashed windows, which are shattered all over the place. It's like a war zone.
How did you actually make your way to this part of the city?
In the direct vicinity of the port area, all the roads are still blocked. Also because the army took over that site. For the past 2 days, again, volunteers have been trying as much as possible to clear the roads. There are cars that are turned over, trees that are blocking the ways, we're trying as much as possible to open up as many roads as we can. This has totally been done on a voluntary level. We haven't seen any institutional or governmental help or support till time being.
Yeah, you put out an announcement for volunteers. Were you surprised how many responses you got?
You know, for the past 2 days, we were just trying to organize ourselves, and we just put a call for volunteers last night. In like half an hour, we had more than 1,000. So they, as of tomorrow, will be going down with a group of 200, having like one coordinator overseeing the work of volunteers in every section.
It is really encouraging to hear so many people stepping up, because we hear that trust is in such short supply in Beirut. There's evidence suggesting all this devastation may well have been the result of carelessness on those in charge of several tons of this ammonium nitrate in the warehouse. So as somebody who's organizing a relief project, how are you getting people to believe in an organization and trust you?
This latest massive explosion, it's kind of culmination of a total regime failure. So that's why you see volunteers all over. People are resorting to non-governmental organizations. So you can really feel that the ordinary people here on the streets are sick and tired of the system at large. That's why people have, they have trust, they believe in what we're doing, and they can feel that their energy is being put in proper channels, where can they really feel the impact, and they can feel that they are really changing lives of the most traumatized, most underserved communities across Lebanon.
Robbie, if the city's authorities are not providing aid, can the residents do this relief effort on their own? I mean, do they have the resources?
When you're talking about major infrastructural support, when I'm looking at this hospital, which is completely destroyed, we have a university nearby, which is also destroyed. You have schools here. You have infrastructure, which has been totally removed. You still need to have a functional system in order to rebuild and reconstruct what's been destroyed. So again, there's a limit to what volunteers or non-government organizations can achieve. We still need to figure out what kind of a structure that needs to be put in place to do this job. It is like a war zone here.
Robbie Shibley, who's leading a grassroots relief effort in Beirut. He's with the City Center for Civic Engagement and Community Service. Thank you very much, Robbie. Good luck with this work.
Thank you.
As rescuers in Beirut comb the rubble, nations are pledging support. Today, French President Emmanuel Macron was in Beirut. Macron toured the demolished streets of downtown Beirut as angry crowds pled with him to help bring change to Lebanon. They chanted, "Help us," and "Revolution." Macron responded that French aid would not go into corrupt hands.
Car au-delà de l'explosion, nous savons que la crise ici est grave.
The French president said, over and above the explosion, we know that the crisis here is a serious one and places historic responsibilities on the current leaders. Rhonda Sleem is a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. All fingers are being pointed at the Lebanese government. How corrupt is the government in Beirut compared with the rest of the world? And when we say corruption, what have they actually done?
Well, the corruption is endemic in the government. It started soon after the end of the civil war in 1991, when major effort was done to rebuild the country. And billions of dollars during that reconstruction process were lost to corrupt officials. As President Macron said, Lebanon has been mired now in an economic, fiscal, public health crisis and political crisis since October of last year. And this has been exacerbated by the pandemic crisis. I mean, corruption is present in every sector of the government. You don't have an independent judiciary. The parliament is seen to be a corrupt organization and not to be representative of the interests of the people. And then you have the head of the government, the executive branch, including the prime minister and the president, are seen not only to be corrupt, but also to be inept.
So those widespread popular protests last fall led to the toppling of a government. The faces changed, but what hasn't changed is the method of governing in Lebanon, which seems to distribute state resources according to ethnic affiliation. So what hope do the Lebanese people actually have for any real change?
The problem does not lie with the faces, as time and again we have seen in Lebanon, is that you have new prime ministers every few years, and yet the corruption is endemic, the inefficiency, the lack of transparency. And so the problem is in the system. And as you said, the system is based on allocation of posts in government according to sectarian quotas and has created a political economy that has fueled this corruption and has underpinned this political system for decades now.
Then there's the elephant in the room, Hezbollah, backed by Iran. State authorities in Lebanon don't dare touch Hezbollah because it's the country's largest armed force. Many people, though, are accusing Hezbollah for many of Lebanon's problems. And not surprisingly, some people shouted at Macron today, "Free us from Hezbollah." So what role does Hezbollah play in the Lebanese government?
Hezbollah has veto power over most of the decision in Lebanese government. A president cannot be appointed without Hezbollah approval. A prime minister cannot be appointed without approval. And this current cabinet is very much loyal and beholden to Hezbollah. Hezbollah is also a political party in addition to being a military organization that represents the interests of one of the largest components of Lebanese societies, the Shia of Lebanon. And so in that respect, there's nobody who argues that Hezbollah can be a political party and should remain a political party. The argument is over the weapons of Hezbollah and the fact that Hezbollah makes war and peace decisions independent of the Lebanese government without involving representatives of the Lebanese.
Rhonda, if we look more broadly at the problem of corruption in Lebanon, how involved has the international community been in trying to get Lebanon out of this rut of corruption up till now? And do you see the efforts changing after Tuesday's explosion?
One good thing about how the international community is dealing with Lebanon, and I think with after significant pressure from Lebanese civil society, is now it's united that no economic assistance will be given to Lebanon, even after this explosion, which is another tragedy adding on other tragedies, without the government of Lebanon and the political and economic elites of Lebanon engaging in serious fiscal structural reforms.
Well, the memo seemed to have gotten through to President Macron, apparently after visiting a pharmacy today damaged in the explosion. He told the crowd, "I understand your anger. I am not here to write a blank check to the regime."
That is correct. As I said, you know, the international community has realized that. And there is this fear now among many of the Lebanese activists. It's because of the size of the explosion and the size of the damage that the international community might maybe move away from this insistence on reforms before dispersing money. Hence, you have now calls from the Lebanese civil society for maybe setting up an independent international mechanism through which these funds that help Lebanon rebuild could be dispersed with oversight from credible civil society organization. I mean, one of the demands that people in the street today ask of Macron, do not give money to this Lebanese government. We need your assistance, but do not channel this assistance through the Lebanese government.
Rhonda Salim, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
With everything going on with the pandemic, you might have missed the major news story of the summer, what I'll call the Great Halloumi Controversy of 2020. The World's Sarah Birnbaum explains.
The situation I'm about to describe might sound strange, but I promise you it happens all the time, especially with Europeans. So the EU and Canada are on the verge of finalizing a huge trade deal. It would cover like 30% of the world's economy. But the tiny island of Cyprus vetoed the treaty, and the sticking point is cheese. Cyprus wants to prevent Canadian cheesemakers from calling their halloumi cheese halloumi, and the island is willing to cause a huge headache for the rest of the EU and Canada to do it. But like I said, this happens all the time. In 2017, the same trade deal came to a halt over, you guessed it, cheese.
The failure to protect feta in Canada now haunts the ruling Syriza party. Its MPs say they won't ratify the agreement when it comes to Parliament.
Cheese was the culprit again in 2019, this time in a deal between the EU and the Australians.
Australian cheesemakers could soon be forced to stop using several names, including feta, Gruyere and Gorgonzola, as free trade talks with the European Union enter their final stages.
This big trade deal with Europe and Canada isn't scuttled yet. The EU still has a few tricks up its sleeve. And ironically, the EU has also used halloumi as a cheese cudgel to get Cyprus to do what it wants. Cyprus is divided between the Greek side of the island and the Turkish side. They can't stand each other, and the EU wants them to unify. So Brussels said, look, if you guys get together, we'll give halloumi a special protected status. But if not, no dice. So really, what's going on now is cheese karma. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Coming up in a bit, Thailand could soon become the first country in Southeast Asia to legalize same-sex marriage. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Going back to our lead story today, let's talk about what caused the blast in Beirut, nearly 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate. Jeffrey Lewis is a professor at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. He joins us now. Let's start with the basics. What exactly is ammonium nitrate?
Ammonium nitrate is a pretty common compound. It's used pretty typically as fertilizer, but it's also used as part of explosives that can be used in mining. Ammonium nitrate, if it is not stored properly, can be quite dangerous. There have been a number of very serious accidents, some involving trucks carrying ammonium nitrate that turned over, others involving ammonium nitrate plants, including one recently in the United States.
Right. So a couple of incidents, in fact. There was also Toulouse in France in 2001 and Xinjiang in China in 2015. So if this happens again and again and causes so much destruction and human fatalities, is there any move to change how it's stored, how it's used, or just ways of protecting people from it?
Well, you know, it is stored quite safely in a lot of places. You know, this is a case where what we saw was a ship carrying this material that didn't have its paperwork in order was stopped by Lebanese authorities. And then it just kind of fell into a legal black hole. So, you know, I do think that safety standards are extremely important. But in this case, what you really have is a state with not much capacity finding itself in possession of a big cargo and then just not knowing what to do with it.
I mean, the images that we saw of this blast are just stunning. What does an explosion of this magnitude compare to?
Well, you know, a lot of people initially thought that to them it looked like a nuclear weapon. But in fact, our estimates of the size of the blast suggest it's quite small compared to a typical nuclear weapon, but much larger than an explosion that, you know, you would typically see. So, you know, as we can see, that's enough to destroy buildings in the vicinity and break glass, you know, for quite a distance away. But, you know, as we're thinking about the anniversary of the Hiroshima bombings, I think it is important to remember that even though this was a horrific and tragic event, it is not as large as a nuclear weapon would be.
As you said, it's also used as an explosive in mining, and it's been used for violent means. I'm thinking Timothy McVeigh in 1995, the Oklahoma City Federal Building. So what does that imply in terms of how to control it?
This is actually now the second time that a shipment of contraband that's been seized by a state fell into, as I say, a kind of legal black hole where it just sat. Several years ago in Cyprus, some munitions sat for 2 years until they exploded. So one thing I would strongly encourage the international community to do is set up an authority and a procedure that when states interdict dangerous cargoes like this, that there is some competent group that can show up, take the material, and dispose of it properly.
Jeffrey Lewis, a professor at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. Thanks very much.
It was a pleasure.
If you're one of an LGBTQ couple in Western Europe, North America, or much of Latin America, you can get married. Not in most of Asia. But Thailand is now preparing to challenge the status quo. A new law would make Thailand the first country in Southeast Asia to allow same-sex unions. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
One of the most famous people in Thailand is a talk show host named Woody Milintachinda. Back in 2016, Woody went on TV and said, "There's something I've been hiding. I'm actually married to another man." Before that, he hadn't come out as gay. We got together on an island, he said, for a small secret ceremony. Under Thai law, that's really all it could be, a ceremony. Because like every other place in Asia, except for Taiwan, Thailand says same-sex unions are not recognized. So you can dress up, say some vows, no one will stop you. But legally, it means nothing. Woody told his audience, "Before I die, I just wanted to experience everything life has to offer, including a wedding." Now, things are changing. Thailand's government is advancing a law that will legalize same-sex unions. It's not marriage per se, but couples would get almost all of the same rights. So for anyone who supports LGBTQ rights, time to pop champagne, right? Well, I talked to Pauline Ngamping, another Thai celebrity who happens to be transgender, and I asked her what she thinks of the law.
Better than nothing.
Better than nothing? That's it?
Yeah, we have to think like that to be happy. You get something, you should be happy with it.
If she sounds not so enthusiastic, well, she's far from alone. Other LGBT groups are also saying to the government, "Hey, it's 2020. You want to make history? Go all the way. Give us full-on marriage." Now, generally, acceptance of LGBTQ people in Thailand is pretty good, Pauline says. You can walk down the street holding hands, no problem. But she says there are always these conditions to that acceptance.
For example, when I come out to the society, they said, it's okay as you are good people. You are a good person.
She says it's like, we'll accept that you're trans as long as you're nice or pretty or good, whatever that means. Pauline says this law makes her feel the same way. Not quite equal, almost second class.
The society is thinking that, okay, being a transgender is better being a robber or criminal. They are comparing transgender with some other bad behavior.
Now, in other parts of Southeast Asia, the government is literally saying LGBTQ people are criminals. In Singapore and Malaysia, gay sex is illegal. In Indonesia, the top psychiatric board says same-sex attraction is a mental disorder. And in Brunei, it's technically legal to punish gay sex by stoning people. Then you have Thailand, where trans people can run for prime minister. That's what Pauline Ngamprin did last year. In one of her campaign ads, she's saying it's time for equality for all Thais. Pauline didn't win, not even close, but still, she made a statement. What's interesting about Thailand is this same-sex union law, it's actually being pushed by a right-wing cabinet, which is super loyal to the military. They're also devout monarchists. These ministers are just very conservative people. But Pauline says,
conservative people, sometimes they're conservative in certain things, but not everything.
It's quite different from, say, the United States, where for decades, the right wing has focused on blocking LGBT rights. Pauline thinks the conservatives here in Thailand just see an opportunity to attract more support. That's why she and others are saying, okay, great, if you really want to support us, give us the full dignity of marriage. Not that this law isn't a big step. That talk show host, Woody, he's like Ellen DeGeneres level famous here, he has talked openly about a common fear among LGBTQ couples. Suppose my husband gets sick, he says. The law won't let us properly care for each other, meaning maybe the hospital won't allow visits. This new civil union law would fix that and let couples adopt kids and share finances. So Pauline says, don't get her wrong, it's good. And overall, she sounds hopeful for the future.
Our societies will develop to be more open for LGBT people as human beings.
She's just saying, if we're going to do this, let's do it right. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. 75 years on, the legacy of Hiroshima reminds us what's at stake in a nuclear arms race.
We were lucky to escape the Cold War with a no nuclear conflagration. And if we repeat the same play now with Russia and China, there's no guarantee that we can actually make it out unscathed again.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH and PRX. 75 years ago today, the world changed forever.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
That's American President Harry S. Truman on August 6, 1945, introducing the age of atomic warfare.
With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction to supplement the growing power of our armed forces. In their present form, these bombs are now in production, and even more powerful forms are in development. It is an atomic bomb.
More than 200,000 people were killed in Hiroshima and in the second attack on the Japanese city of Nagasaki 3 days later. Japan quickly surrendered to the Allies, ending World War II. Historians argue that many more people could have died, both Japanese and Americans, had the war continued. Still, the grainy films of mushroom clouds over Japanese cities is unforgettable. We saw something like that again this week. If you're like me, you've been gripped by the news out of Beirut over the past few days. If you're like me, it'll be embossed on your mind for months, even years, that image of that mushroom cloud rushing at you like a locomotive, a massive boom, and then as the air slowly clears, the widespread destruction emerges. We know it was not a nuclear bomb in Beirut, but it hinted at the horror. When I was in college, I kept a grim reminder on my bedroom wall of those horrors. A civil defense map of New York City printed during the Cold War, with concentric circles radiating out from an imagined ground zero, Columbus Circle, 59th Street, in Midtown. The key on the map indicated that glass and steel buildings in the immediate vicinity of the blast would be vaporized. That's what happened in Hiroshima 75 years ago today. It's something the world should not see again. Our friends at the national security podcast Things That Go Boom have been looking at nuclear arms control. It's a story that spans decades, first building up stockpiles, followed by attempts to try and reduce them, and where that effort stands now. Here's reporter Lacey Healy.
The Soviet Union has decided to transform Cuba into a base for putting all of the Americans under the nuclear gun.
The United States' answer to what Adlai Stevenson termed Soviet blackmail in
Security
Cuba
Council was designed to find a way out of this calamitous situation.
President Eisenhower renews his open sky plan to prevent surprise attack with a striking...
History is made again in an historic room of the White House, the Treaty Room.
The first time in history, the language of arms control was replaced by arms reduction.
And make the United States and the world safer and more secure.
During the Cold War, Americans learned to duck and cover because they were living with the ever-present threat of an atomic blast. The Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 60s brought us right up to the edge of the nuclear abyss. And over the next 50 years or so, treaties between the U.S. and Russia kept bringing us back. But those treaties haven't necessarily been popular with everyone.
I remember some colleagues at the State Department coming into my office and talking about they were concerned that some folks on Capitol Hill were making trouble for the agreement, that there were critics who didn't like the treaty in general, were just trying to make mischief.
That's Alex Bell. She's a former State Department official and senior policy director at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Lately, she spends a lot of her time defending treaties because, well, as the threat of nuclear war has become less ever-present, the rationale for those treaties' existence has begun to slip away. That leaves the door open for critics to do away with them entirely. And, well, that starts to get pretty scary. When Trump took office, there were four existing treaties. The Iran deal.
It requires Iran not to enrich uranium to weapons grade for 15 years to reduce its number of operating.
The Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty.
This was the first reduction treaty. The Soviet Union and the United States destroyed over 3,000 perfectly good nuclear weapons that they had.
Open skies.
A long-standing agreement between the two countries and NATO partners to allow military surveillance over flights.
And something called New START.
Both sides would reduce U.S. and Russian nuclear arsenals by 30%.
But one by one, Trump has been leaving them all. And now, New START is all that's left.
The U.S. has announced its intention to pull out of a key nuclear weapons treaty, and it is blaming Russia.
Russia has violated the terms of this treaty in several different ways.
The New START treaty is the last major bilateral arms control agreement between the United States and Russia. And what it does is restricts each side to 1,550 deployed nuclear warheads. And I know that sounds like a lot, that you would have 1,550 nuclear weapons pointed at each other. But at one point, we had about 12,000. So we've done a good job of bringing those numbers down from fully insane levels to, you know, mildly insane levels.
New START also allows us to have a real-time look inside Russia's arsenal, and vice versa. But when he announced the U.S. intention to pull out of open skies, Trump was wishy-washy on New START.
When we have a treaty and the other side doesn't adhere to it, in many cases they're old treaties, old agreements, then we pull out also. So I think what's going to happen is we're going to pull out and they're going to come back and want to make a deal.
And some experts are saying that the Trump administration's skepticism of this type of treaty and track record of leaving now three other arms control treaties could mean certain death for New START.
The U.S. killing this treaty now is a major blow to the nuclear security safety net. It will lead to even more unraveling, particularly with the new START treaty that has constrained Russia and the United States' strategic long-range forces.
In Trump's view, the U.S. shouldn't be party to any deal that other nations aren't complying with. The arrangement disadvantages the U.S. in his mind because it unnecessarily hamstrings America. The best move, he'd argue, is to either renegotiate a deal that benefits the U.S. more or get out of it entirely. But if New START isn't extended in February 2021, it'll be the first time in 50 years that we don't have on-the-ground insights into each other's nuclear forces.
And that's dangerous, because when you don't have that kind of excellent daily intelligence from each other's side, you start to plan based on your assumptions rather than the reality. And the more you're doing that, the more the risk goes up of miscalculation, of accidents. And that's exactly why we got into arms control in the first place.
Right now, New START can be easily extended. The extension's actually built into the treaty, and Russia has said it's interested. But the Trump administration is holding out. Chris Ford is the State Department's Assistant Secretary for International Security and Nonproliferation. Here he is on PBS NewsHour back in March.
The future vision that President Trump has outlined for this administration of a trilateral arms control agreement that includes both Russia and China.
So they're hoping to pull China into a new comprehensive agreement and threatening to walk if it doesn't agree.
If China is indeed the kind of responsible power that it proclaims itself to be, that there is no alternative but to sit down and take that kind of responsibility seriously in the strategic nuclear realm as well.
Alex says that's not likely to work.
The Trump administration, they want to have this new trilateral arms control agreement between the United States and Russia and China. And China has said many times that it is not interested in this kind of a negotiation, often points out that the U.S. and the Russians have exponentially larger nuclear stockpiles and need to get their own houses in order before we talk about further multilateral nuclear reductions.
Experts estimate that China has about 290 nuclear weapons, whereas the U.S. and Russia each have over 6,000. So basically, China's saying, call us when you get down to 300 and we'll talk limits. But as for making a deal now, America and Russia, this is your thing.
It's absolutely essential that China eventually be pulled into these kinds of agreements, and we should be laying the groundwork for such a time. But they will join an arms control agreement when they think it's in their national security interest to do so.
I'm Lacey Healy, and you're listening to Things That Go Boom, a special feature today on The World. The coronavirus has put an exclamation point on our competition with China, ramping up the tough talk on both sides. And according to the Washington Post, officials inside the administration have even begun discussing the possibility of a return to nuclear tests.
Yeah, one of the first reactions I had was, you know, when Americans were saying we want tests, this was absolutely not the kind of test they were talking about.
The heyday of U.S. nuclear testing began with the Manhattan Project, and the bulk of those tests were conducted in Nevada and in the Marshall Islands, on or near indigenous lands, far from policymakers in Washington, D.C.
What state in the union is going to have to take one for the team so the Trump administration can prove to the world that we still know how to explode our nuclear weapons?
The heyday ended in 1963, when the Partial Test Ban Treaty did away with testing in the atmosphere, underwater, and in space, but not underground. According to the Post, the proponents of testing argue that the U.S. should resume testing now, because Russia and China have been conducting low-level nuclear tests of their own. But so far, there's no evidence that's true. Alex says there's another reason for the threat of nuclear testing.
The reporting said the Trump administration wanted to kind of pressure China to the table through this demonstration of a nuclear explosion. And if we, you know, are going to burn down the house around us in order to get the Chinese to the table, I don't know that that's going to work.
Because a return to nuclear testing isn't just a little bit of a provocative act. Communities are still dealing with the environmental and health consequences of the last round of U.S. testing.
This month marked the 70th anniversary of the first test of a nuclear bomb.
In a part of New Mexico's desert called Jornada del Muerto, or Journey of Death.
Boom, that thing exploded.
A tremendous flash came first.
I mean, it was a big explosion. It wasn't like the regular ones we'd been hearing.
But no one told residents to evacuate, even as radioactive ash poured down.
It was on our food. It was on our chickens.
Some radiation levels were almost 10,000 times what is currently allowed in public areas.
The government came into our backyard and used us as guinea pigs.
There isn't a family in Tularosa that don't have somebody in their family with cancer. Maybe
there's too much cancer here.
Which is part of the reason why we haven't done it in almost three decades. We even signed, but haven't yet ratified, a treaty banning testing altogether. Which, by the way, some allies of the president have pushed him to unsign. Not to mention, a lot of experts say that a new nuclear test at this time could lead other countries to follow suit.
And on the point of great power competition, I think what we're not talking about is, what are we competing over? Mm-hmm. What is the goal of what we're doing here? Are we going to compete in an arms race? Is that the goal? Is it a conventional and nuclear arms race that we're facing? And it kind of looks like we're going out of our way to start one rather than preclude one.
The way that we're modernizing, the way that Russia and China are modernizing, the way we're talking to each other, are we already in an arms race?
Well, there's certainly heavy investments on all sides. The Chinese are massively increasing their investments in conventional forces, but also moving away seemingly from what has been their posture of a minimal deterrent, that they feel comfortable with a small amount of nuclear weapons, feel that that would deter any possible nuclear attack, and also have had a no first use policy stating that they would never be the first to start a nuclear war. And there are definite concerns about China moving away from that posture and from that policy.
And the situation could easily escalate out of control. Recently, Trump's special envoy on arms control, Marshall Billingsley, said that the administration is willing to spend Russia and China, quote, into oblivion to win a new nuclear arms race. Spending we might want to reconsider in the middle of a global recession. But also, spending that might set us on a path towards something worse. Could greater competition and sort of going along the path that we're currently on, are there feasible ways in which that leads us down a path to nuclear war?
Yeah. So we were lucky to escape the Cold War with minimal damage and no nuclear conflagration. And if we repeat the same play now with Russia and China, I just, there's no guarantee that we can actually make it out unscathed again. In all likelihood, the longer we go with this nuclear status quo, the more likely it is that a nuclear weapon is going to go off again. And, you know, nuclear weapons are indiscriminate destroyers of life, infrastructure, the environment, and no country in the world is prepared or ready to handle that kind of a disaster or manage the aftermath.
That actually just like set me back a little bit.
I'm sorry. I'm no fun at parties.
No, it's I still feel like a disconnect there. That's like what makes it feel really real. And, you know, I mean, I think that that's the same thing that people thought when they looked at all of the warnings about global pandemics. And we said, you know, we are really lucky that this hasn't happened yet. It's going to happen. And it doesn't feel real until you're in the middle of it, and then it's too late.
Yeah, this pandemic just proves that we've been ill-prepared for a low-probability, high-consequence event. And that's exactly what a nuclear detonation, a nuclear terrorist attack would be.
Low-probability, high-consequence event. The kind of thing that we might just be a little too complacent about until it's too late. I asked Alex what we can do now to reduce the risk of disaster.
It would be really great if the United States would stop dropping out of treaties. That would be my number one goal for this immediate period of time. But we just have to start talking to each other. And arms control is hard, but really it's the only way we're going to get ourselves out of the situation we seem to be sleepwalking into right now, assuming that we can just keep building new military assets, new nuclear weapons, and possibly manage this all. The Trump administration's really squandering away the inheritance that it received from so many U.S. administrations before that went out of their way to build this very intricate infrastructure to manage conflict, to prevent war. And, you know, one by one, they're just ruining these agreements. And, you know, if we desperately want to get back into a great power competition that mimics the Cold War, except for with one additional actor, we're well on our way.
Alex says, other than climate change, the threat of nuclear war is the only existential threat to mankind. And right now, we're doing pretty badly at preventing that threat. For the world and things that go boom, I'm Lacey Healy.
Lacey Healy is the host of Things That Go Boom, a podcast about national security from PRX and Inkstick Media. There is always more to the story, like why did we all learn to duck and cover to avoid nuclear disaster? Turns out it's not as dumb as it sounds. Hear that part of the story on Things That Go Boom. Find it anywhere you get your podcasts. All next week on The World, we'll be featuring Lacey's reporting on global threats that don't look anything like traditional warfare, threats like a pandemic and xenophobia. Join us for that next week. In our weekly look at climate change solutions, we're going to the ocean and how the tiny critters living there are cleaning up the messes we make. Today on The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The World's Environment producer, Anna Kussmer, is with me. Anna, I gather we're digging into the Big Fix mailbag today.
Yes, Marco, we have a listener question. This one comes from Brian Gasalvez from Raleigh, North Carolina.
I listen to The World through my local radio station, WUNC.
Brian has a question about how the oceans relate to climate change solutions. So last month, we did a couple segments about planting trees and forest protection as a way to store carbon. Brian says he was remembering in his college biology class learning about these tiny little organisms that live in the ocean that do a lot to remove carbon from the atmosphere.
So I'm wondering if we should focus more on keeping these microorganism ecosystems thriving rather than planting trees, or maybe both? Thank you.
That's an interesting question. So what is the answer?
So the short answer is yes, these tiny little creatures in the ocean, they're called phytoplankton. They absorb a lot of carbon from the atmosphere, and they're an extremely important part of keeping global atmospheric carbon in check. So yes, trees are very important, but so are these microbes. I love Brian's question because I think it's a great opportunity to talk about such an important part of the global carbon cycle.
So I have still my high school understanding of how trees work. They take in carbon, they pump out oxygen.
Yes, good.
Remind me, Anna, exactly how phytoplankton works. How do they help remove greenhouse gases from the air?
Phytoplankton are like these little microscopic plants, and they do exactly what plants on land do. They get energy from the sun. They breathe in carbon dioxide, and they breathe out oxygen. Some of them, a small fraction, sink to the bottom and get stuck down there. And it really adds up because there's just so many of them, even though it's a small fraction, a ton of carbon ends up at the bottom of the ocean. Scientists think it's around 10 billion tons a year, which accounts for about a quarter of human-made greenhouse gas emissions. So it's pretty significant.
That's unbelievable, all at the bottom of the seafloor. And what about Brian's question? I mean, it sounds like he's asking if there's a way to supercharge these critters to make them take up more carbon or somehow plant more. I mean, is there?
This has been a major source of research in the past couple of decades among ocean microbiologists. There have been these experiments that have dumped iron into the ocean to supercharge the growth of these phytoplankton. Lack of iron is the main thing that limits their growth, so adding iron helps them grow very quickly. In short, these experiments didn't really work like scientists were expecting them to. There are other research projects in the works to maybe look at different ways to help boost their growth. But there's also a lot of skepticism out there about these types of projects. You're messing with really complex, really essential systems. You could end up really screwing things up and possibly even making it worse.
So it's tantalizing, but it sounds like the short answer here is, for now, boosting the growth of phytoplankton is not a realistic part of the solution to climate change. They're sucking up as much carbon as they're ever going to.
While supercharging these phytoplankton didn't really work, they're still part of the solution. Anything we can do to take better care of the ocean is good for them. They are threatened. Climate change could make them less productive by up to 20%. Efforts to protect areas of the ocean from human pollution, overfishing, these are all important to help keep these systems working the way that they have for millions of years.
The World's Environment producer Anna Kussmer and Brian from Raleigh, North Carolina, thanks very much for your question.
Thanks, Marco. And we want more questions. If you heard about a climate change solution in the news and you want to learn more about it, or if you remember something from high school biology like Brian and you want us to dig in for you, please email us at climate@theworld.org. We'd love to answer your questions.
To conclude this week's Big Fix, we bring you the final poem in a month-long series from young writers around the world sharing their reflections on the climate crisis. This week, we're off to the other side of the globe, New Zealand, and a young poet who's been thinking about the injustice of climate change.
My name is Shanti Mathias. I'm 20 years old. I live in Wellington in New Zealand. I think I wrote this poem because there's this incredible disconnect between this way that the environment gives us solace, nourishment, go running every day, and just seeing nature and being in green space. I'm so sure that that helps me to be stable and happy. There are also things that make me just feel so much despair. So just as the environment gives us hope and nourishment, it also makes us afraid because it keeps changing. This poem is trying to unlock those connections between those two different aspects. Anthropocene echoes. Most of us know we'll leave something behind. Most of us want it. On my most selfish days, which are most of my days, that is what I want. Leave an impact. Change the world. These are easy things to say, and how they're said in valedictorian speeches and inspiring tweets and in heartfelt father-daughter advice. I do want to change the world, but I don't want to remember that I have already changed it. I don't want to remember that hills become holes so I can type on a silver laptop I'm proud to own. I don't want to remember the devastating storms that wrench Pacific Islands apart as I fly over to continue my education. I don't want to remember that my leather bag was made from the skin of animals whose sweaty bodies rubbed far too close together. There's ruination coming. Some people have received it already. I have not. Maybe I never will. Unless I choose. I can choose to share pain and alleviate suffering. Somehow, somewhere. These are cliches of their own. I'm not going to stop resenting them. I will make wrong choices when my days are measured. I'm not sure if the net balance will be positive or negative, but for today, I'm choosing to have hope. I live in the Anthropocene. The world is never going to be the same. I'm not sure I want to change it, but the change has already happened, and it's not going to stop. I'm going to use every shred of courage I can find to admit that again, again, and again, and then try to make up for it.
That was Shanti Mathias reading us her poem, Anthropocene Echoes. It was produced by Uzair Emud and Anna Kussmer in collaboration with the educational organization Write the World. To read the poems from young people around the world that we featured in the series, go to theworld.org/bigfix. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.